The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, Chancellor Angela Merkel is on the ropes. That's the way one UK newspaper sees it. Over the weekend, there were more demonstrations, thousands of protesters turning out on the street to voice their disapproval of the Chancellor's refugee program. And, of course, the prophetic implications of this ongoing development. They're absolutely huge. It's something to watch for sure. Today we'll be looking at that. We'll also be looking at some of the recent comments made by Pope Francis. He was recently in Poland for the World Youth Day festivities. And during that trip, he had quite a lot to say about Islam and the recent terrorist attacks in Europe. On Saturday in Poland, I think he spoke before 1.5 million people, many of them young people. World Youth Day. And speaking of youths, I just have to spend some time on an article that that frankly is difficult to stomach. It's in Spiegel Online, an article about the Islamic State's child soldiers. The heading reads, "First Come the Sweets, Then the Beheadings." It's really a heart-wrenching piece of what life is like for young people inside of the Islamic State. Now, as it happens, these couple of developments or these stories come at a time when we welcomed 36 of our own young people here to Edstone for the first of what we hope will be many youth camps. Here in the UK, summer camp in Britain. It started for us last night with camper orientation, and already the campers have been off and running and in a couple of activities this morning on campus. Later on in the show, in fact, we'll be heading outside to speak with the man who was really the most instrumental in preparing the campus, the Edstone campus, for this youth camp, Brad McDonald. He also occasionally fills in on this very program. So we'll be talking with him later on in the program. I don't think I have the interview skills that Barbara Walters has, but I do think you'll enjoy the discussion, especially if you happen to be a listener who has entrusted us with your child, with your teenager, for the next couple of weeks. That interview with Mr. McDonald, that's coming up later in the show. Well, this piece on Merkel being on the ropes, just a couple of tidbits before I get to the Daily Mail article from the German press over the last few days, this from Die Welt. It says a majority of Germans consider Merkel's asylum policy as a failure. It says after the attacks and acts of violence from refugees, 57% of Germans say the course of the Chancellor has failed. More than half, 57%, say that this course, this refugee policy, is failed. It's failed. Another one here, Bayern Courier. It says, will the attacks of Würzburg, Munich, and Ansbach change everything? Will the mood turn against the welcome culture? These are the questions the talk shows discuss these days. And then it says later, one thing is clear, Merkel's refugee policy was catastrophic. That's one thing that we know a majority of Germans are saying. These are catastrophic policies. These are policies that have failed. Well, over at the Daily Mail here in the UK, it said yesterday, Merkel's premiership is hanging by a thread today as thousands gathered to call for her resignation while a key political ally dramatically withdrew his support over immigration policy. That's speaking of Seehofer down in Bavaria. But it writes here of the 5,000 or so that turned out to protest in Berlin. It says here the chancellor faced a fresh wave of fury after it emerged that two recent terror attacks and a third killing were carried out by men who entered the country as refugees. Now, you know the story here. So many of these refugees are coming in. Many of them are young men, okay? And by the tens of thousands, they're impossible to track. They come in and then the German authorities just lose sight of them. I just want to play for you. This is a couple minutes of reporting from the BBC about these protests on Saturday.
Scores of people are currently protesting in Berlin. That's against Chancellor Merkel's migration policies and the government's security failures. Our correspondent Peter Oliver reports from Berlin.
What you see just behind me is a whole group of people that have come out to voice what their opinion is, and it's emblazoned on the flag right in front of me. It says Merkel muss weg. It's bending around a little bit as we come into the streets. Merkel muss weg, which means Merkel must go. They want to see the German Chancellor step down. They're citing her actions over her refugee policy, which saw over 1 million people arrive in the country last year. The latest statistics say almost 200,000 people arrived in the first quarter of 2016. They're angry at what they see as Angela Merkel not doing her duty by the German people. I spoke to some of them and asked them exactly why they're out on the streets of the German capital today.
I had these opinions before the terror attacks. This isn't something that has come suddenly. If we don't do something to stop it, then things will only get worse. That's why I'm here.
This has been a very bad week for Germany. It's not acceptable that we let people into our country without the correct checks. We have a situation with people arriving and it's unclear what their intentions are. That's why we need to clearly define our borders.
Well, following four attacks in the last 12 days, two of those directly linked to Islamic State, tensions have been running high here in Germany. Now, it was certainly felt amongst the crowd. You're seeing many signs saying that the refugees should be sent home, others calling for saying that Islam doesn't have a place here in Germany. But the underlying message that goes throughout all groups in this crowd is that they think it's time that the German Chancellor move to one side.
And Merkel isn't only facing a backlash from the public. Some politicians have also joined the angry chorus against her and the leader of Bavaria, where three recent attacks by radicals took place. He's distanced himself from the leader's policies.
And so you can see where this is leading. You combine all of these elements. What a mixture. What a toxic mixture. The wave of refugees, more than 1 million over the last year. Many of them young men, young Muslim men that German authorities are unable to track. And you add to that ISIS calling on Muslim men to attack Europeans. Now, certainly not all of them are violent in this group, this million man army, you could say. But some few, of course, are willing to fight for ISIS, for the Islamic State. And Chancellor Merkel has really stubbornly insisted on going forward with this open-door policy. And as that report brought out, and it's referred to in the Daily Mail piece as well, she's starting to lose key allies, including, as I say, Horst Seehofer, the conservative premier in Bavaria. I mean, if her coalition begins to break down, in the view of Daily Mail, I mean, it's only hanging by a thread. But the implications of this prophetically, as I say, they're massive. The Daily Mail says, speaking after a meeting with the Bavarian government in Tegernsee, it says, he added that the solutions to date were too inadequate, stressing he had no wish to start a quarrel with Merkel's party. Seehofer said it was important to look reality in the face. An axe rampage, a shooting spree, a knife attack, and a suicide bombing in the span of a week stunned Germany, leaving 13 people dead, including three assailants, and dozens wounded. And it goes on to note how three of the four attackers were asylum seekers. And then it refers here at the end to Merkel's recent speech. It says here, in a powerful speech on Thursday, Merkel said that she would not allow jihadists to keep her government from being guided by reason and compassion. Despite the great unease these events inspire, fear can't be the guide for political decisions, Merkel said. It's my deep conviction that we cannot let our way of life be destroyed. And so she presses on. Business as usual. No changes to the refugee policy. And it's remarkable, really, when you consider some of the recent statements from the Pope, Pope Francis. He's out there with a similar message to proclaim. Look, we've got to keep those borders wide open. And with respect to the violent acts of terrorism, well, as he told those gathering on World Youth Day in Poland, I don't have easy answers to these questions of why suffering. I can't really explain to you why it happens. What I can tell you is that this world can sometimes be cruel and selfish. But he doesn't know why. And he doesn't know why we're having these ceaseless acts of terrorism. Senseless. And then he talked about, well, the one thing that we can't do is close down the borders. He told the young people in Krakow on, I believe this was on Saturday, to believe in a new humanity. I'm not sure what that means exactly. I mean, it sounds nice, I guess. Believe in ourselves. Believe in a new humanity. The AP said, said Francis in his final homily of the pilgrimage, demands of us real courage, the courage to be more powerful than evil by loving everyone, even our enemies. It says later, let me see if I can just find this quote about borders. After earlier in his pilgrimage, Francis had expressed dismay that many people and places aren't welcoming enough to refugees or those fleeing poverty in their homelands. He is just kind of stunned that places, well, like Poland, the place that he visited, that they aren't welcoming enough refugees, if you can believe that. I mean, more and more you begin to wonder just how much does Pope Francis speak for Catholics in general? And how much does Chancellor Merkel speak for the average German? There's lots and lots of discontent, and it's building. They're out there on the streets calling for Merkel to go. But how much longer can Pope Francis go on with this message? How many more attacks will he be then going out there with this message of, hey, let's open the borders. Let's make sure that the borders are wide open. This is from a Reuters piece, also about some of the Pope's recent comments, particularly after he was questioned about the recent killings, the recent terrorist attacks, in particular the beheading of that Catholic priest in Normandy. Reuters says, aboard the papal plane, Pope Francis said on Sunday, this would have been yesterday, he said on Sunday it was wrong to identify Islam with violence and that social injustice and idolatry of money were among the prime causes of terrorism. I mean, he sounds like he's a member of the Obama administration, that these terrorist attacks are motivated by social injustice. It's just poor young Muslim men that are sitting around thinking, I wish I had more handouts from the government. And if I don't get them, I'm going to go run over 84 people with a bus or with a big truck. Social injustice, idolatry of money, but I mean, it has nothing to do with radical ideology. It has nothing to do with religion. The Pope said, I think it's not right to identify Islam with violence. That's what he said on the plane yesterday, heading back to Italy. That's not right, and this is not true, he said, to associate Islam with violence. He said here later, I think that in nearly all religions, there's always a small fundamentalist group, and well, that's obviously true. In fact, it's historically, Oftentimes, it's much worse than that. As I was saying last week, I mean, there is a huge, massive religious war coming. We're going to see some dramatic changes in Germany, and we're going to see it in the Vatican as well. But right now, he's doing like so many other leaders in the world today, just drawing a moral equivalence between these terrorist attacks and other acts of violence. The Pope said, I don't like to talk about Islamic violence because every day when I look at the papers, I see violence here in Italy, someone killing his girlfriend, someone killing his mother-in-law. These are baptized Catholics, he said. Well, like I said, it makes you wonder just how much longer he's going to be, you know, really speaking for the majority of Catholics, if he is even now. I mean, there is a point to be made about just the senselessness behind so much of the crime and violence, whether it's a terrorist attack or not. But here again, he has no answers for that. He told the youth at World Youth Day, I can't tell you, I can't really explain to you why there's so much suffering in the world today. There are no easy answers to this. And as I was telling our young people at orientation last night, there are answers. If you understand God's purpose for man, if you know what happened in the Garden of Eden and how man has been cut off from the truth, cut off from the tree of life, cut off from God's knowledge, and left to go that way for 6,000 years, you know there's an explanation. You know there's a reason. And we know because of Bible prophecy what's going to happen next. We know where this is leading, what it's building toward. There is an explanation. There's a lot that you can say about this world and about why there's so much suffering and violence. This piece here from the Chicago Tribune, and you know, it's not brought out the age, the number of young people involved in this, but certainly the majority of those getting caught up in the senseless violence in the city of Chicago, the homicide rate, which is just shooting through the roof. So many of those killings, so much of that violent crime, it's carried out by young black men. Here again, young men in their early 20s, or in some cases, not even out of their teen years. There was a story or a headline I saw just yesterday. A young black man, 16 years old, a boy, really, who, for whatever reason, decided to kill his father and his mother right there in their home. He shot them both, killed them both. Well, this piece here in the Chicago Tribune, homicide rate surging for black Chicagoans. Chicago's per capita homicide rate climbed over the last decade, and the chances of an African American being killed in the city spiked drastically. I mean, this is the real danger that African American males, young men in the African American community, this is the real danger that they face when they leave their homes. Now, this is what their parents should really be concerned about. From 2005 to 2015, the city went from 17.3 homicides per 100,000 to a rate of about 18.8. But the report held particularly troubling news for African Americans. The rate for blacks in Chicago jumped from 36.1 homicides per 100,000, that was in 2005, to 46.5, just 10 years later. 36 to 46. The overall rate is at about 17 to 18 per 100,000. It says here other studies have shown steep drops in the city's African-American population in recent years. Well, you can understand why. People are moving out of those black communities. It's too dangerous. Well, the population is in decline, but the crime rates are skyrocketing. There's fewer people there, but there's worse crime. And it's made worse by the fact that there's an all-out attack on the police. coming from left-wing politicians and the left-wing media. It's the police that are out there targeting the blacks. That's the message that so many young black youths are getting from their leaders, their irresponsible leaders. Criminal, really. Look at this world today, and look at the just total lack of leadership that you see in any given region. And then, too, you can tie in this reoccurring theme of how so many of these violent, hateful, racist, divided blocks of people, they're young people, they're youths, they're children, they're teenagers. You contrast all of that with what we're here at God's Youth Camp teaching our young people, as I tried to communicate to them last night. What a blessing it is to know what we know in God's church and to have answers, to know why there's crime and violence, to know why there's so much suffering, why there's so many people on earth today who are in pain and agony. You look at the movement sweeping across Syria and Iraq and Libya, and then those elements moving into Europe. Here again, much of the hatred and the violence and the bloodshed, it's fueled by the younger generation. Speaking of ISIS, I've just got to tie this comment in. It was made last week, and this was when, of course, everybody in the States was pretty much fixed on what was happening there in Philadelphia, the Democratic National Convention. But during that time, this was on last Wednesday, the FBI director, James Comey, he made this alarming prediction about what might well happen if ISIS is crushed in Syria and Iraq and Libya. He basically suggested that if that happened, that there'd be some kind of terrorist diaspora that's just truly frightening. This is what the FBI director in the U.S. had to say last week.
At some point, there's going to be a terrorist diaspora out of Syria like we've never seen before. Not all of the Islamic State's killers are going to die on the battlefield. Hundreds and hundreds of them, when the coalition succeeds, and I'm confident it will, in crushing the Islamic State, through the fingers of that crush are going to come hundreds of really dangerous people, and they're going to flow out primarily towards Western Europe, but we might as well be right next door to Western Europe, given the ease with which people can travel. And this is an order of magnitude greater than any diaspora we've seen before. A lot of terrorists fled out of Afghanistan in the late 1980s and early 1990s. This is 10 times that or more. And so that's a threat. We saw the future of this threat in Brussels and in Paris, but we in the American counterterrorism business are constantly focused on that. That's not here yet. That challenge is going to come.
That challenge is going to come. Really, in so many ways, it's already here. I mean, you've had, in the case of Britain, for example, you've had hundreds of British citizens who've gone down to Syria through Turkey to fight on the battlefield with ISIS in Syria, in Iraq. And as many as 600-700 that have returned to Britain. I saw another story and heard some audio. I didn't bring it with me for this program, but a Muslim preacher in Wales talking about how that the Quran allows for all of this sort of behavior and that this is justified according to the Quran. It's right here, right next door to Edstone. A Muslim preacher going on with all of this hateful, inflammatory rhetoric. It's already here. But what happens if they are smashed eventually by the West? Well, they're not going to kill all of them. And those scattered remains are going to scatter about throughout Europe, in the UK, in the United States, Bloomberg had this to say about that warning from James Comey. Hundreds of terrorists will fan out to infiltrate Western Europe and the U.S. to carry out attacks on a wider scale as Islamic State is defeated in Syria. That, according to the FBI director. Comey's blunt warnings echo those of Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump, who has scoffed at Obama administration efforts to defeat Islamic State extremists in Syria and Iraq. Nonetheless, the FBI chief's comments reflect a consensus among U.S. intelligence officials that the group inevitably will strike out abroad as it continues to lose ground militarily under attack from a U.S.-led coalition. Well, that, as I say, may already be happening. When we come back, we're going to look at another piece that has to do with ISIS, in this case, the Islamic State's child soldiers, if you can believe it. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of the Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week, condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com, sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
The Trumpet Daily.
At an orientation last night with our 36 campers and all of the volunteer workers and college students there present, I was just pointing out how so many of the victims of the recent terrorist attacks are young children, those that were shot up at McDonald's in Munich a couple of weeks ago, mostly teenagers, down in Nice, France, with the 19-ton truck that terrorist used to mow down 84 victims. 10 of them were little children, babies even. And then one individual that was listening to that lecture last night that I gave, he came up and noted afterward, just in conversation, that it wasn't just the victims, so many of them that are young, that are female, women, youths. But he said, if you look at the perpetrators, most of them also, most of those terrorists also are young, some of them not even out of their teen years. You know, a 20-year-old getting into a semi-truck to crush human beings. Or someone to put out a call or an announcement for free food at McDonald's so that he could then shoot young people that show up. Well, he himself was a young person. I mentioned that example on a recent program in the West Bank, that 13-year-old girl in a kibbutz that was stabbed to death, some 30 or 40 stabbings on that little girl, 13 years old. That terrorist that broke into her home, well, the terrorist was 18 years old. He was a boy. He was a youth. Look at that example in Chicago, as I said in the first segment. Black-on-black crime. It's a rarity when the black-on-black crime involves 50-year-olds or 60-year-olds, unless they're the victims, I suppose. But most of the ones carrying out those violent crimes on the city streets of the United States are young people. Look at this piece here in Spiegel. As I say, it's hard to stomach. First come the sweets, then the beheadings. Then the beheadings. It talks about these two little boys, Ahmed and Amir, held hostage by the Islamic State for 9 months imprisoned, and then brainwashed. They withstood beatings and were brainwashed and were prepared to be, as they're called here, the lion cubs of the caliphate, the child soldiers of the caliphate. Der Spiegel says here, it's difficult to determine how many child soldiers Islamic State is training. Experts estimate that about 1,500 boys are serving the terrorist group in Iraq and Syria. Some are born to the militants. In fact, more than 31,000 women are currently pregnant in Islamic State-held territory. Other children arrive with their parents from abroad when the parents join the jihadist movement. In many cases, the lion cubs, quote-unquote, are also children of local fighters or orphans who join Islamic State voluntarily. Others, like Ahmed and Amir, are kidnapped. It says here, ISIS divides the boys into two groups. The younger, weaker ones were to remain in school to learn the Quran. The older boys were sent directly to military training in Mosul. Ahmed and Amir were taken into a training camp with 200 children. ISIS wanted them to forget that they were Yazidis. And these two little boys, they kept their mouths shut when they were in those training camps. Youth camps! ISIS youth camps! They were too afraid to say anything. They were paralyzed with fear. It says here, ever since ISIS began losing territory in Syria and Iraq due to increased military operations against it, the terror organization has beefed up its propaganda efforts aimed at children. Aimed at children. I read a quote last night to our youths, Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, saying that the most important group that we can reach, it's the young people. When you educate them the right way, when you bring them up in the truth of God, what an investment. What a long-term return you can get on that investment. Well, Satan understands that principle well as well. And he knows that if you can get those little minds twisted and perverted at an early age, well, you can produce some kind of demon-possessed radical that will be willing to carry out just about any atrocity you could imagine, and some that you can't. In the mornings before sunrise, Ahmed and Amir prayed. Then they learned the basic skills of a child soldier, how you disassemble a Kalashnikov, how to set an improvised explosive device, how to detonate an explosive vest. ISIS men beat them with sticks and kick them in the stomach to make them tougher, as the men put it. In the evenings, the brothers laid on mattresses filled with fleas. Their bodies felt dead, they say. Their thoughts revolved around their mother and father, who they had last seen waving to them as they were taken away on the ISIS truck. Well, the reason we now know this is a reporter got to these two lads after they escaped from one of these training camps. And she had to make four separate trips down to northern Iraq just to try to get closer to these boys who were still, even though back with their families, who were still paralyzed with fear and didn't want to talk about it. It was so horrible. ISIS gave them black Afghan outfits to wear and took them to the front, says Ahmed. They wanted them to see the enemies, the PKK, Yazidis, and so on. On one occasion, a militant beheaded a Yazidi before their eyes. "We will kill you too unless you convert," the men told them. It was during that time that Amir, the gentler of the two brothers, stopped talking. He just stopped talking. He had seen enough. It was too much to stomach. It was too much for him to go on communicating. ISIS also gave them pills, which they didn't want to swallow at first, but then they noticed that the adults who took them seemed more self-confident afterwards. "When we swallowed the pills, everything changed," says Amir. "Their fear disappeared, and so did the stabbing sensation in their hearts." The brothers began to believe that the Yazidis were inferior. Every evening after training, Ahmed slipped away to some bushes behind the dormitory. He had hidden a mobile phone there on the ground under some branches, which he used to send messages to his mother. "Hello, Mama. We're alive." Or, "I miss you." Well, he got caught getting on the phone, and an ISIS member smashed his foot and beat him. Well, it goes on in this article to talk about the way that they recruit these youth. Some of them as young as 10, 11 years old. They bring them along. They give them sweets, like many young people enjoy and like. They let them learn what it means to be patriotic, to hold an ISIS flag. And then gradually they're brainwashed on the videos, filled with violence. And then they practice those forms of violence, first on dolls dressed up in orange jumpsuits. They practice beheading the dolls. And then they learn songs about the jihad. It says, finally, these two escaped, as I said, regarding one of them. It says, ISIS locked him and 34 other boys into a bare room that became their prison for the next 20 months. Every morning before sunrise, a female ISIS teacher would come to the room and wake them to pray. After that, they studied the Quran for 7 hours, and to encourage them to apply themselves, they were promised, as if they were in a fairy tale, "If you're good, you'll be allowed to see your mothers." Well, it's a chilling article about these so-called lion cubs that ISIS is really focusing on now that they're backtracking some in Syria and Iraq. They're really going after the youth. Now, let me just give you a refreshing contrast. This is from Psalm 45. I read through this psalm last night with our young people. This beautiful psalm that talks about marriage and family, and that talks about how much of a blessing our offspring are, or should be, our youth, our children. Psalm 45:1, "My heart is inditing a good matter. I speak of the things which I have made touching the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer," it says. This is a psalm or a song about a king on his marriage day. It says, "You are fairer than the children of men. Grace is poured into your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. God has blessed this king forever and ever." Who could this be? Verse 3, "Gird your sword upon your thigh, O most mighty, with your glory and your majesty, and in your majesty ride prosperously because of truth and meekness and righteousness. And your right hand shall teach you terrible things." Well, our coming king, our Messiah, is indeed a conquering king. And you can see why he has to be. This right hand, in Scripture, it's symbolic of power and authority. And look at the way Jesus is represented in traditional Christianity today. No wonder the Pope has no explanation for why violence and suffering. Christ is coming back to this earth as a conquering king. The traditional Christian world has rejected this truth. They've rejected the many prophecies about this truth. And so all that they know is this world that they've been brought up in. And as the senseless acts of violence and murder and bloodshed, as they multiply, well, you have religious leaders who offer no explanation as to why so much suffering. Verse 6 says, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of your kingdom is a right scepter. You love righteousness and hate wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your fellows." The Apostle Paul quotes this very passage in Hebrews 1. And over there, he applies these verses to Jesus Christ, who will soon replace Satan on the throne of this earth. That's what this is talking about here. Jesus Christ, and then the bride, verse 10, hearken, O daughter, and consider, and incline your ear. Forget also your own people and your father's house. Here the attention now shifts to this beautiful bride who's told to forget about her people, her own people, her father's house, and to instead identify herself solely with the interests and the objects and the purposes and the plans of this righteous king. Leave and cleave, the Bible says. Leave your father and mother and join yourself to your husband or to your bride and become one. Verse 11 says, so shall the king greatly desire your beauty, for he is your Lord, and worship you him. He's your Lord. He's your husband. We worship him. Verse 13 says, the king's daughter is all glorious within. Her clothing is of wrought gold. And then verse 15 says, with gladness and rejoicing shall they be brought. They shall enter into the king's palace. So it all culminates here. This passage, it culminates in this glorious marriage. And then look at the fruit that comes from that marriage. Verse 16 says, instead of your father's, keep in mind, she was told, you know, forget about your father's house. Forget about your predecessors. Instead of your father's shall be your children, whom you may make princes in all the earth. Focus on the offspring. This is where the real glory and fame resides, in the children. This is to be your legacy. The royal marriage between Jesus Christ and his bride. Well, that's going to produce offspring by the billions. As God's family expands on into the world tomorrow and beyond. But as I was telling our young people last night, just 36 of them, a far cry from the youths attending those satanic and perverse camps in Syria and Iraq, a far cry from the 1.5 million that turned out in Krakow on Saturday to hear the Pope. As I was telling our young people last night, 36 of them, this family legacy has already begun. It's already begun. This world needs leadership. The young people of this world, they need a shining example, a shining light on a hill. Well, that process is starting, and it always starts small. That's the way God does it when he works through human beings. It's a mustard seed beginning, as Jesus said in the Gospels. But we have to see where this is leading. We have to see what God is doing with his families and with the children of those marriages in God's church. My father wrote in the Key of David booklet, we must continually remind our young people that they are God's princes and princesses of the earth. They won't remain princes and princesses. They're to become God's kings of the universe. This is the most exalted calling ever. And so we talk about God's royal standard at God's youth camps. We talk about the God family vision. We talk about preparing our young people to lead this world, to learn how to demonstrate God's way of life so that they can teach by example. What a sobering responsibility we have as parents, as educators, as ministers, as fathers, as mothers. Verse 16 again says, instead of your fathers shall be your children, whom you may make princes in all the earth. There's no doubting the fact that you can have a profound impact on young people. Notice the word, you may make, or that phrase. There's a proverb that says, train them up in the way that they should go. And when they're old, they won't depart from it. It's a beautiful way of life. But look at what, well, look at what so many young people in the world today face on a daily basis. A nightmare scenario for these two youths that somehow managed to escape that ISIS camp. 11 years old, those two. Well, God here in this psalm says in verse 17, I'll make your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore shall the people praise you forever and ever. That name will be remembered because we're talking about God's family. My father in that same booklet, the Key of David booklet, talks about how that this message, this vision is not just for adults in God's church alone. It's for our young people. And then he said this, and I gave this to the youth last night in orientation. He says, the main lesson that we need to get across to our young people is how to live the rich and abundant life now. Then they can help teach the whole world. My father said, this world's full of glitter and glamour and sinful fun, but it's only fun temporarily, not truly joyous living. When Jesus Christ returns and sets up the kingdom of God, abundant living will begin for all the world. No human being can truly imagine what life will be like in the millennium unless we let God show us through the Key of David vision. That's what God's doing at this youth camp, showing us this Key of David vision, showing us how to live the rich and abundant life, even now in the midst of this very dark and evil world. But that way of life, these youth camps, these youth programs, these academies, these colleges, they're going to populate the earth. They're going to spread right across the earth. In just a few years, as God begins taking this way of life to all of mankind after the return of Jesus Christ to this earth, when we come back, we'll head outside to speak with the assistant camp director at this year's Philadelphia Youth Camp at Edstone, Mr. Brad McDonald. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the show. We've moved our massive production crew out of doors to the beautiful Edstone campus, and I'm standing here with Brad McDonald, the assistant camp director. Also, for you listeners, you're familiar with him because of KPCG. He fills in on the Trumpet Daily radio show and also comments from time to time on Trumpet Hour. And as I say, he's here assisting as the assistant camp director, and has put in quite a lot of work to get the campus ready for our first PYC at Edstone. Before you tell us about that, you had a couple of lectures this morning, Bible 1 with all of the boys and then all of the girls, and I sat in on the boys' class with you. You had quite a lot of response with the questions you asked on the subject that you were talking about. Maybe you could first start by just summarizing what you spoke about this morning.
Sure. Well, my goal with this morning's lectures was to really just help the campers develop their foundation in the Church of God. I really encouraged them to really consider and prove two questions. The first question was, does God exist? And then the second question was, is the Bible God's Word? And I just went through, with each point, I gave them two or three ways to answer that question. Does God exist? And is the Bible God's Word? And then I just showed them that if the Bible is God's Word, then we can use that standard to know where God's true church is. We can take biblical teachings and look at all the churches in the world and just ask the question, you know, with the Sabbath, for example. The Bible teaches the Sabbath. the true church is going to be found teaching the Sabbath. And you can just go through doctrine after doctrine in the Bible and just ask the question, is the church teaching this doctrine? And any church that's not teaching what the Bible says can't be the true church. So I just showed them how, hopefully, that they can do that simple exercise to prove that this is the true church, and that the church that really is defining so many aspects of their lives is true. It's where God is.
I should mention as an aside here, we're standing just outside the youth camp nucleus, the marquee, the huge army tent where we have our dining area and kitchen. And so if you hear some peripheral sounds, that would be that. Going back to your lectures, though, quite a few of the guys kept you on your toes. They had some good comments and even threw some Bible passages out there to answer some of your more general questions. What did you think of the overall response?
I was really impressed. Like you said, not only did they identify some of the more common prophecies that we use to prove God's existence and prove that this is the true church, but some of them raised some more obscure, or let's say less well-known, prophecies and passages too. And the girls were just as good as the guys. They were just as active in terms of asking questions and giving thoughts. So a big congrats to the parents out there who have got teens over here at Edstone. We've had some great participation so far.
Yeah, an excellent start, just a good foundational Bible class to begin things for all of the dorms, as it turns out. We have four dorms here. There's nine campers per dorm, so we have a total of 36 campers. And maybe before you tell us about all the work that went into preparing the campus for these young people, tell us about their accommodations.
Well, the girls are staying in Edstone. One girl's dorm is staying in the AC girls' apartment up top on the third floor, and another girl's dorm is staying in the AC men's apartment. And all of the AC men have moved into a tent at the back of the property, and that's where we've got the campers as well. We've got four tents set up. We've got a campers dorm in a tent, two tents, and then we have one large tent that we're using as an area to store their clothes and hang their suits and shirts and store all their bags. And then the fourth tent is filled with, well, there's three or four AC, male AC staff in that tent.
And tell us about the scorching summer heat here in the West Midlands.
Well, I guess about a week ago it reached the terrifyingly hot temperature of about 90 degrees, which really did send the country reeling. Thankfully, it's cooled down now. It's averaging about 70 or 72 each day, which is beautiful.
The high for today, August 1st, 65 degrees.
Is that right? It did feel a bit cooler. And the nights are quite cool, which for guys sleeping in tents, I think you would prefer it to be a bit cooler than too hot. They definitely, in the mornings, we're giving them extra blankets so they can stay warm.
Right, the campers came out for orientation last night, which we held outside on the patio there adjacent to the Edstone building. And most of them having experienced camp at Edmond, Oklahoma in July, they just came in their short sleeve T-shirt. And then by the end of the orientation, there were quite a few of them that were pretty cold.
Right. Yeah, I was talking to one camper, and he said the only reason he even had a jacket was because his mother encouraged him or made him take one. He was going to roll up with T-shirts, three or four T-shirts, and that was going to be his lot.
All right. Well, now the campus. There's a lot that has happened here in the last few months. We mentioned the marquee structure, the nucleus of the campsite, as you told me earlier today. But tell us a little bit about the last couple of months, the work that you've put in along with the students to just get the campus ready for youth camp.
Right. Well, we've done a lot. You know, we started with the top priorities first. When campers arrive, they need a place to sleep, they need food, and you know, they have those basic needs, which meant building some temporary showers. We built four temporary shower cubicles for the boys, which are in the cellar of Edstone. So every morning or every evening, they come up and they have a hot shower. We put a sink in there so they can brush their teeth and shave and things like that. We've built this marquee area. That was quite a big job. It meant putting down a foundation and leveling the ground and compacting the ground. And then we put down a couple hundred big concrete paving stones. to provide a clean, flat surface that people can walk on, which is brilliant because it means that we'll have a permanent area where we can have activities like this. Even we may take the tent down, but we're always going to have this nice flat paved area for weddings and things like that. We've marked the basketball court. We've installed basketball goals on the basketball court. We've built a football pitch, and the grass has really come in excellent on the pitch. It's thick and lush. We built our own soccer goals. We've done a lot of clearing out along the creek and a lot of cutting grass. And then concurrent with all of that work, we've also been painting every window and every downpipe and every gutter on Edstone Hall itself. So it has been a really busy summer. The students have worked really hard, but it's been incredibly productive.
Well, the campus looks great, and from the beginning of the camp here, I think the young people are thoroughly enjoying their experience, as are the workers. You're listening to Stephen Fleury along with Brad McDonald, as I just mentioned, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send your comments or any feedback to the program, send those emails to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.